Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. Tape number 373, side 2, January 26, 1979. One of the tragedies of Jonestown, one of the terrible tragedies, besides the fact that there may be 120 zombies out loose and a group of 60 or 70 that helped surround and create this monster and make Jim Jones the fall guy for all these poor elderly blacks and these children. One of the biggest tragedies is the story of the children that died down there, because, of course, it wasn't suicide. And I, as I said on my first tape about the private electrode base at the Santa Monica Mountains that the doctors wanted for experimentations on poor children and Indians and blacks and find out what provokes violence and so forth. I have always believed, since this Jonestown story broke and after a week of reading about it, that it was a place that they were to use for mind control and experimentations, and that nobody who went down there except the corduroy of the inner guard could leave, and everybody had to be killed. I bet they were in some stage of extensive drugging and experimentation, and that they had kept them isolated down there for those purposes. Los Angeles Times has a story, and it's sad it doesn't make the Associated Press or United Press, just in little bits and pieces, by Bill Drummond. It says, roughly one-fourth of the Jonestown settlement was made up of children under 16 years of age. One of the tragedies is that the deaths of these youngsters, they were fed this sweet poison by adults, got down to Jonestown, and they don't know whether it was laxity on the part of the child welfare system, or the federal or the state system, because the federally funded foster care program for foster children could be involved. And the issue raised, according to this article by Bill Drummond, is on the adequacy of supervision by welfare authorities. I'm reading from this article. It says, not all of the Jonestown youngsters came to Guyana with their natural parents. And this is what I've been trying to say all along, that these people were shuffled down there and were very ripe for experimentation because there was no father or mother to care for them. Some children were wards of the state courts. They were under control of the People's Temple, and temple members were named as foster parents or legal guardians with really no right to them. They were being investigated up in Mendocino and for having these children with no license that were sent to them from Oakland and even from Los Angeles. So they quickly said, oh, I'll adopt them, and then they began to keep them under their hands and could send them down to Jonestown with them in 1976. The mass migration of the poor and the black began at that time. The welfare officials in the San Francisco Bay Area have confirmed the People's Temple members were made foster parents of dozens of children in 1976 before the departure. Mendocino County Welfare Director Dennis Denny said 150 California children were sent to foster homes run by members of the People's Temple. In an interview, Kenneth Wooden, founder of the New Jersey-based National Coalition for Children's Justice, said that at least 100 foster care children died at Jonestown. He said he's written about articles in 10 newspapers. The San Francisco officials are hiding it. They're admitting that no more than 3 former foster youth were down there. But Wooden says, my contacts are telling me that everyone in the Bay Area Welfare Department is scared. I don't believe the official explanations. Put yourself in the welfare official's shoes. They authorized the placement of kids. They authorized the money. They picked up the paper and then find they're all dead. Are they going to rationalize that? No, they're going to protect themselves, said Mr. Wooden. They're not being truthful. Now, Senator Alan Cranston, Democrat from California, is investigating through the General Accounting Office just how many children were there. And you might write to Cranston. I will be writing to him. I've been meaning to all week. Susan Martinez is on his staff, and he's trying to locate exactly how many children. But then Cranston said the circumstances and the doubts surrounding the Guyana tragedy justify an inquiry by the General Accounting Office. It's impossible to tell. The questions opened up, and it's impossible to tell how many were there because of the military pathologists using the most modern techniques. They still can't identify the youth. Well, it doesn't matter whether they recognize them by name or not at that department. They had their passports. As I said before, They have their entry into Guyana. They knew exactly which children went in there in order to get into that country. And if they didn't come back alive, they're dead. It's just that simple. You don't have to have a name tag. If you have the names of 150 children with either a family passport or their own passport, and you go into Jonestown through Georgetown and through Guyana, and they had the fingerprint of everybody there, if they're not back, they're dead. So there shouldn't be any conflict. They're questioning the guardianship route, how the youthful wards got to Jonestown. Before 1976, they had extensive operations in Ukiah, Mendocino County, and the temple members brought approximately 150 foster children into the county from other jurisdictions, some of them from far away as Los Angeles, some around the Bay Area, and this is what they're trying to unravel. Now, I believe that these children were turned over to them for experimentation, even if it's experimentation on mass suicide, but children were beaten and hit with planks and put under boards and kept under these boards a length of time, and they were brutalized and made to laugh, and then they were beat up again and made to say thank you. And I think that this kind of training of mind control and testing them could have been going on. I have an article here from the Knight News Service. Maybe you saw it and maybe you didn't. Unfortunately, the articles that I'm sharing with you today don't go over the wire service. That is one of the tragedies in this country, that certain newspapers have one story and another city has another, and they're not the Associated Press or the United Press. This one is Knight Rider newspaper, January 21st, on the torture house shop in, it's a tourist place now in Iran, in Tehran, run by the Savak. The house was burned down, and they said that a group of guerrillas burned it down December 27th. But I'm sure that among those demonstrators were some Iranian police that wanted the Savak house torn down as the Shah was leaving, and they made sure to get rid of it. But everyone has been going through, the article says, looking through the house, scrabbling around, searching for bones, thumb screws, a garret. A garret is a medieval collar that was manufactured, I think the Americans made a lot of torture machine for various countries around the world. And this is a metal collar that you put on the neck with huge spikes, and as you tighten the collar, the spikes get into the throat, and you don't die instantly, but you suffer plenty as they tighten the neck screw. And they had those garrets in the house, and fingers and legs, pieces of arms and legs found around in a box where prisoners' hands were stuck and then chopped off, and streaks of walls with blood stains. Why am I going into this with you? For a particular specific reason, that the house was inhabited for 20 years by the Savak, right near the U.S.-American Embassy on Babar Street, a few blocks from the U.S. Embassy, and it was run by two families. There were three women and two families that lived in this house. And they would go every day in and out and do their marketing or have a job or whatever to mislead people that this wasn't a torture house of the Savak. But a neighbor said that for 20 years they heard death screams and they knew about it. And then at that house, they had a tunnel. It was a safe house, and there was a tunnel that went under there and went to a police hospital. And you can imagine what went on at that hospital. They call it Pahlavi Slaughterhouse. And there's signs on the wall now, "We will swim in blood until we get to the shore of freedom." As the reporter was talking about, they found another leg over at another house. In the movie, The Serpent's Egg, that I talked about on a tape about a half a year ago, it tells about the rise of Nazi Germany in 1922 and how it was apparent very early. The serpent's egg you can see through as the serpent grows larger and larger in the sack. You have an idea of what's going to sprout, that Nazism just didn't sprout in 1933 or 43. In 1922, the serpent's egg was starting. And the important thing here is that you have people running that house that are Iranians, women, families, and it's a type of operation that could go on in Jonestown. The people that you're looking out at that escaped, that survived, and some that died, I'm sure, that were in it, like Marie Katsaris and some of these other women, were very much a part of a cover. And I want to make that perfectly clear. I'm positive that these people that we're seeing, these so-called defectors, set it up, know there's 26 million floating around, got their asses out, managed to survive, and let it come down on these other people that they knew were going to die. They knew they were going to die. Even Mark Lane knew it when he went down there. He didn't arrange to leave with Charles Gary on the same plane as Congressman Ryan. He chose to stay there and hang around and take a plane the next day. There's never been a good study, a psychological study, of the people who played the string quartets at Auschwitz when they came in the concentration camp to sign "The work will make you free," and they thought they were going to work and get a nice clean shower. They had string quartets, Brahms and Brahms, and Beethoven, you know, Bach and Brahms, Beethoven, beautiful music, Mozart, you name it, very relaxing coming through the gates. And they looked like normal people playing that lovely music and having their dinners and enjoying their lives. And at Jonestown, there were these people who had special food, that ate special food, while the other people were kept, like, in slave ships. There were maggots in the food and in the bunkers. I just can't get over much of Jonestown's horror that the news wants to forget, and you'll have to forgive me if I go into this a lot on the tapes until it really sinks into our heads what happened. When you don't study the past, you know the old saying, then history does repeat itself. Jim Jones had it over his little throne. It wasn't like the Shah of Iran's throne, but it was a throne, and it's just as deadly for the kind of work that is done. Out of the past, I mentioned when Jonestown first started that I thought that these doctors, Dr. Frank Irvin from UCLA and Dr. Vernon Mark, the neurosurgery, head of neurosurgery, Boston City Hospital, worked at UCLA, and that was a school that was going to study the causes of violent behavior. Dr. Irvin's still professor of psychiatry at UCLA. And those two men are now defendants in a lawsuit that's been pending since 1973. That 6 years ago, I was waiting for this lawsuit to take place, and I've mentioned it on other tapes, and I'm referring to an article again. Not the Associated Press, United Press. This is from the Herald Examiner by Gene Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. A suit over brain surgery. And this is that famous man, Leonard Kiley, K-I-L-L-E, a former electronics engineer. He's described as an electronics engineer, like Mr. Paisley was a former CIA man. Actually, I understand that Kiley invented the Polaroid camera and that Mr. Land had taken it over, the other laboratories had taken his invention over, and they put him in the hospital. He was one of the first persons, one of the first or second human patients to wear a STIMO receiver, a device developed by Dr. Jose Delgado at Yale Medical School. Dr. Delgado is important because of the monkeys that he trained with these metal plates before he put them into human beings, where he could give orders similar to the buttons that you put with your television to press and turn the television on or off. Delgado has been working on experimenting on human brains to make people like robots so that they could make good soldiers and not question their duty to their country. And Kiley was a very learned man. He's offered his research and his engineering work. He said, "I endow all my inventions to MIT, all my medical writings to Harvard." He says there are electrodes in his brain. They're burning his cell, the cells of his head. He puts a wastebasket over his head to try and stop the microwaves that are generated by the electrodes. And they did a test. The scientists are in the court, and this article says that scientists are watching the court proceedings and said that low-level microwaves are generated by the electrodes and that the burning was an exact description of what is going on in Kiley's brain. He has sued the doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital. They put the electrodes in his head in 1966, and in 67, he was put in the hospital by a woman that he was married to. She had another man living at the house, and he was losing his temper, Leonard Kiley, and throwing things at her. And she said that he was paranoid and didn't trust this man. So she got his temper good and worked up, and by the time he had his electrodes in his head, she divorced Leonard and married the man that he thought was stirring up the trouble in the first place. That's how paranoid he was. He was described as a brilliant man in the medical reports by Dr. Mark and Irvin, But one of the goals of Dr. Delgado was to take somebody who's really smart and see how their brains differ from people that are not quite so intelligent. So one of his goals was to take somebody and put this electrode implant into his brain to control his behavior on the outside. Leonard Kiley was in Los Angeles at the Veterans Hospital for a while, and he was suffering and having tremendous pains in his head. And the doctors corresponded with the doctors at Boston Hospital and said, what did you do to him? And they were curious on what procedures were done. And you know, the doctors back there were so unethical and so, I guess, ashamed of what they did that they didn't even tell them that this particular man still had the electrodes in his head, and they're placed way down in his brain, and they're there now, and he says that his head is burning. This $2 million lawsuit has been going on for so long, and as I mentioned once before, for those who remember the tape, there was a novel written by Michael Crichton called The Terminal Man. Crichton went to Harvard Medical School. He was a graduate who was doing residence training at the hospital at the time of the surgery. And he wrote a novel, and they made a movie. Everybody made a buck off of this, except this poor man whose brains are still burning, and he hallucinates. And they say he hallucinates. He can be told, I guess, electronically what to do also. And he says that the microwaves are murdering him, and he's had to suffer for this since 1966. And the very doctors who did it to him continue to be heads of departments at the Boston Hospital, UCLA, and they're renowned for their work, and this scandal hasn't even touched them. They were the people that were supposed to handle welfare patients, poor blacks, and one of the purposes is to find out why blacks riot during times of unrest, such as the Detroit riots were the signal to go ahead and examine the brains of blacks to see why they behave at a certain time. And this is what the UCLA school was going to do, to study the causes of violent behavior. And then when that was stopped in 1973, I believe that it was moved down to Jonestown, that these people were the subject of experimentations, both with drugs and behavior. And there was a wing there that you might have read about in the newspaper where young people who wanted to leave Jonestown or were punished for this kind of criticism of Jim Jones, whatever it was, were put in a special hospital wing kept by this Judith Parks, and she was shot at the airport. The men made a point of killing specific people, and they shot her, and she was one of the people in charge of that wing where men or women or children stayed a week or more and then came out described as having a lobotomy. I suppose that she was killed as a defector in case she would talk about what was going on in terms of the experimentations. There's an article I do want to mention a little bit about Iran and what's going on there, because whatever happens there and in Vietnam eventually will happen in the United States. Transitions are either going to be easy or they're going to be hard, because what we bring on these other countries eventually is going to come to our own shore. And I don't want to do too much on Iran, but I want to talk about Mr. Khomeini and Ramsey Clark. Ramsey Clark was urging Jimmy Carter to back Khomeini in Iran, and we know that Jimmy Carter was one of the men instrumental in getting the Shah out. The Shah described a study in his room where Jimmy Carter had been last New Year's, New Year's before this, celebrating with Rosalind Carter and the Shah and his wife. And he said that that room had a cold chill, the Shah said, because after Jimmy Carter left that palace, his troubles began. And I believe that the military, the Pentagon, wanted the Shah of Iran out. He'd been a puppet of the United States for 25 years. But I think they want to bring in somebody even stricter and make even more conservative changes and even possibly begin again with the Reinhardt-Galen agents, to use the Nazi agents that worked with Adolf Hitler in the Middle East and begin to surface them. The Nazis surfaced in Chile with swastikas and flag as soon as Allende was murdered. All of the French press is owned now by a man who was a Nazi during World War II with the Vichy government, except for Le Monde. The main press in every city is owned by a man who was in prison as a Nazi collaborator. Germany's having elections, and both candidates are members of the Nazi Party. They were part of the Nazi Party. there's an editorial this week, why can't they choose somebody different? It's 30 years now, do they always have to pick Nazis? But Ramsey Clark, he was the Attorney General under Lyndon Johnson, the man who concealed the conspiracy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the extreme rightists and racists that were behind that, that even the House Select Committee, is as bad as it is coming up with evidence of that right-wing racist conspiracy. That's what Ramsey Clark covered up as the Attorney General, and let those killers get away, and they're still free. But Ramsey Clark is urging Jimmy Carter to back Khomeini, and when you realize the political role of Ramsey Clark, you have to say, well, who is this man he wants in? This is a man who, in quote, says, "Before us we see the Jews making a mockery of the Koran. The Jews and their foreign masters are plotting against Islam. They're preparing for the Jews to rule the entire planet." And he said he's afraid of their methods, that they'll have a Jewish ruler, and that he's going to back to business. When Khomeini gets in, he said there's no room for opinions or feelings in the system of an Islamic government. He's warned them that he represents the wishes of the prophet. 80 lashes is a punishment for wine drinker, 100 lashes for the fornicator of ill repute, stoning to death of a male or female fornicator of a previously chaste reputation. And Khomeini has said, we want a ruler who would cut off the hand of his own son if he steals, and flog and stone his nearest relative if he fornicates. That's who Ramsey Clark wants in to replace the Shah of Iran. But worse than that, Khomeini has an unknown background. He's a religious leader that the people know as a religious leader, but he's only lived in France the last few months. He's been in Iraq. He's described in an article in the San Francisco Examiner as a man of mystery. The people, 1 or 2 million people, are out there demonstrating for him. But he's described as a slick and intelligent man with a slick political machine, an organization that turned into a model of efficiency. He arrived in Paris 5 months ago, and he's arrived with a group of people around him, Westerners. They seem like westernized Iranians, and few of them are older than 40 years old. They have effectively taken over His Eminence's relationships with the outside world. They are completely unknown, even to Iranian journalists. Nobody seems to know where they come from or where they have been, at least recently. They are not amateurs. They have learned the trade somewhere, certainly and not in Iran. They field reporters' questions with an assurance. They are well-trained operators. And this goes into the Khomeini operation. What he was doing in Iraq is a mystery. As I say, he's been in Paris just 5 months. And it very could easily be that all the Nazi agents that were set up by Reinhard Gehlen, Hallmar Schacht, who funded the Reichsbank, who put Hitler into power, and then left from Europe and began to fund Mr. Sadat, a member of Hitler's inner team. It may be that in Iraq and Egypt and the whole of Middle East and Iran, you have the whole Nazi Bormann Brotherhood ready to surface. And if you have that, if you have this thinking, along with the rest of the Arab world and France and Germany, going with the old Nazis, members that were of the Nazi Party during World War II, not neo-Nazis. I hate the word neo-Nazi. I hear it on radio and television all the time. They're the same old Nazis. Maybe some of these young men, 40 years old, weren't around during World War II. They are neo-Nazis, but the leaders, the money behind them, the genius behind them, the organization behind them, James Angleton worked with Nazis. Walter Dornberger was a Nazi. These aren't neo-Nazis. John Paisley worked with Nazis. Reinhard Gehlen's alive, head of Hitler's Nazi organization. Some of them are dead and some are alive. So when Mr. Khomeini gets in, it's going to be a very interesting ball game. That doesn't mean that I wasn't glad that the Shah got out or that Savak was broken up. I think the symbolism of getting rid of Savak was great because nobody thought it could be done. And once that can be done, there can be other changes. But while we're working for changes, there should always be an alternative of what to do about the things that are bad in this country, whether we're going the genocide and the rampant inflation, the racism, the assassinations, the famines, the cancer everywhere in our environment and our food, we should be thinking of alternatives and not look for some leader and a system that's going to sweep us off our feet with every answer. Otherwise, we will end up like Nazi Germany. We have to have provisions and safe gaps that work now and not have somebody like Khomeini. He'll be put into office. And I believe that Mr. Schlesinger and Mr. Brzezinski and those people that I talk about so much that want a hot war against Russia and are violently anti-Semitic could move the Shah out in order to get something even tougher and tighter and meaner than the Shah. That's pretty hard to do, but they can do it, and they're putting this kind of a government into Iran now. So it's going to be pretty bad, and I wonder where Jimmy Carter's human rights is going to go. You notice he never talks about justice in Saudi Arabia or Iraq. And let's see what he does with Iran when he gets this government in. If he didn't like the Shah, and I didn't either, let's see how Mr. Khomeini behaves. I bring out on this tape the quotations of Khomeini because they come right out of the Elders of the Chronicles of Zion that were written by the Tsarist, the Solidarist, the Colonel Orloffs, and the George de Morenschild, George von Morenschild teams that went to Henry Ford of Ford Motor Company and gave him this story that the Jews want to rule the world and run the world, and they'll take over the world. And this anti-Semitism was set all over the world in South America and funded right out of Detroit and the Ford Motor Company. If you saw 60 Minutes last week, there was a segment for 20 minutes on 40 or more organizations, Nazi organizations, in West Germany right now forming. And they had a lot of literature, which they're not allowed to print in Germany, and the post address was in the United States of America. The printing is done here and sent to them, and stickers to put on the streets and symbols for the Nazi resurgence. It goes from the United States to Germany. It did before, and it will now, and that's why I say the United States officials are giving Mr. Khomeini these lines to read, and they, once more, it's coming from the United States, and this is the third war they're building themselves up to, and persons in the United States keep having to send out this propaganda in spite of the fact that there is no basis for this kind of fear. And if you read Who Rules America and the rich and the super rich and the oil companies and a good hunk of the profits, the Mellons, the Vanderbilts, the DuPonts, Stanford, and goes on and on, Giannini, none of them are Jewish. Gulf Oil, Mobil Oil, the Mellons, Buckley's, there isn't a Jew among them. There's some wealthy Jews, but the large hunk of the the railroads, the minerals, the oils, steel, gas, and utilities are not even touched by Jewish families, and they wouldn't run Iran, and they don't control the United States. I finally got a hold of a copy of a book that I've been wanting for a long time. Tom Davis from Research got me the book from England, Treason for My Daily Bread, by Mikhail Lebedev. His brother went to London and brought home a few copies. They're not enough to tell you to order the book yet, and I think it'll be quite expensive. He's not sure if they can be shipped from England to the United States. But this is the book that alleges that the fatal headshot that hit President John Kennedy over at the side of the fence was done by an agent working for the Nazi Reinhard Gehlen, the Gehlen agency, through Martin Bormann's connections, actually, down in South America, sent a man to New Orleans who met with David Ferry and Clay Shaw. And, of course, Clay Shaw worked with Reinhard Gehlen. He was in Germany with Reinhard Gehlen, and he was head of the International Trade Mart in New Orleans. That's the man that Jim Garrison said was involved in the Kennedy assassination. Tom outlined a good hunk of this book for me, but I'm going to have to read it myself and go through it. But there's a lot here about the Grand Mufti and the Fuhrer, the German Reich, and the links of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem to Adolf Hitler. And that, again, is what I'm afraid is going to be coming out in the Middle East very soon, are these agents surfacing because of the links of the Grand Mufti and Martin Bormann, who did go to Jerusalem and Middle East. He didn't go directly as a war criminal from Italy to Argentina or Paraguay. He went to the Middle East on a refugee ship. As a Jewish refugee, he went off to the Middle East and then to South America. Another thing I worry is how many other refugees stayed in Israel and are actually Nazis. I've heard many stories about this possibility, and it's something you have to keep in mind as the Middle East situation foments. But I'll try and read this book during the week and review it for you next week, and don't order them yet from Tom, but he does have a few copies, and he's going to get more from England, and I'll let you know when they come or if he wants to sell the few that he has on hand now. If he does, you can line up. I think they're going to be expensive. They'll be around $20 because he only has just a handful. But I'll review it for you next week. I hope I can read it during the week. Treason for My Daily Bread, Mikhail Lebedev. I finally got the book. It's been a year. I'm glad to know someone could go to London and get it, and I'll share it with you. And next week we'll go into that, I hope. Take care of yourself now. And this is Mae Breslin Carmel. We'll be together next week, and keep well until then, okay? Thank you.